And so we reach the next in the series of the Culture Shapers, podcast companions for a series of masterclass movies in many ways. Movies that have, by their very nature, not only connected with science fiction audiences, but also influenced filmmakers across the decades and indeed continue to do so as we head into the 21st century. We put this out to a variety of tenders. Obviously, we've already heard Phil Leonis and Dean Haglund share their views on 2001 A Space Odyssey, the Metropolis, Fritz Lang's Metropolis, and of course Logan's Run, which we launched the series with. And now it's the turn of an ace photographer and now filmmaker and writer and general Renaissance woman who's moved from New York to the wonderful west coast of the States. She's also been a award-winning maker of such delightful scenarios as We Are All Cylons and so on. Ilana Raine, it's a pleasure to actually connect with your good self on this edition of The Culture Shapers. How are you?
Oh, wonderful, Alex. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Excellent. Well, just to sort of set the scene, we're launched with just a little excerpt from Sir Arthur Bliss and his incarnation of the movie we're about to discuss. And I think people already begin to get that sort of sense of the march from Sir Arthur Bliss and, of course, London Symphony Orchestra with The Shape of Things to Come, or H.G. Wells' The Shape of Things to Come, which, of course, is the movie we're going to be talking about today and in this particular podcast. Something which was written by Herbert George Wells after what was perhaps his most prolific period of producing The Time Machine, The Island of Dr. Moreau, The Invisible Man, and, of course, War of the Worlds. This was a little bit later. This was when H.G. Wells was a megastar. He was a superstar. I mean, if you combine Tom Clancy with J.K. Rowling, this was the kind of league H.G. Wells was in. So he was clearly a very influential writer and somebody who actually had particular views and philosophies. Alexander Korda, likewise, one of the cinema's leading lights in terms of imagination and producing things. I'm intrigued initially to ask that question, Ilana, as a filmmaker yourself, what was it that made you initially hone in on the 1936 incarnation of Things to Come directed by Alexander Korda?
Well, you know, what's interesting, I mean, I've always been strongly influenced by H.G. Wells and his work, his writing, and the films that have been adapted by him, but on his work. And, you know, I think there's a timelessness of it. And if we can step away from, you know, critiquing a science fiction film that was made in the 30s with, you know, a certain amount of limitations, you know, we have such a high expectation for science fiction films, for films now that portray different realities and outer space. So if we can just step away and look at what the essence of that film is and how I feel has really stood the test of time, it's made in the 30s, that it's, there's something historical in its nature. And in the way that it was filmed, it's almost like a historical document based on Wells' book of the time, which was really supposed to read more like a diplomatic treatise than a fictional novel. And, you know, it brought me immediately into our contemporary situation with what I feel is the doctrine of endless war, a way of engaging with the world as we are a superpower. And I lump the UK and America, you know, as similar superpowers, of a way of approaching the world through the lens of war, and war as progress seen by certain powers that be and the populations that are beholden to these powers, and how civilizations come, go, get destroyed. And in Things to Come, this is the story. It's the story of, you know, century long war, basically, and then the progress that happens. But at the end, what's amazing is that I feel that it's still the same thing, and that we're bound to repeat over and over again, which leads me to, this has all happened before, this will all happen again, which, as you know, is from Battlestar Galactica. So I see this as like a feedback loop that Wells started with his science fiction narratives that carries on into our present day and easily applicable to our current situation, politics.
As we've said, H.G. Wells and science fiction, they go together in so many kind of clear ways. This was actually the only screenplay that Wells actually produced. I think he had a deal to do three screenplays at the time, but this was the one that he effectively viewed. So we can say that if we have this concept of the writer and the writer's intentions and sharing with Alexander Korda the sort of viewpoint of this, it's as close to kind of his views in the mid-1930s as you can kind of get. Interesting that it's 10 years after Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Mm-hmm. It's also at a time where, I mean, the opening sequence I found actually even recently, just watching it again, quite chilling because of the sense of Everytown. Now, initially when I watched it a good few years ago, Everytown for me was London, or it was that kind of notion. But using the concept of Everytown and using the constant barrier and also launching it at a period which is Christmas, which is festive, where there's a holiday season that's actually there. But in the backdrop, you have this constant drum beat, a bit like Arthur Bliss's March there. The drums of war are beating, and there's that sort of manifest almost sense of destiny or inevitability, tragically, about the thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a book by the journalist Chris Hedges called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. I'm not so sure if you've read it or not. It's a very moving book. And in this book, you know, he draws on classical literature. I don't recall if he actually talks about things to come, but and his experience as a war correspondent. And his argument is that war seduces entire societies. And war creates fictions by the powers, the superpowers, that the public must believe and must, in fact, rely on to continue to support these conflicts. And it's this belief in these fictional narratives that actually gives human beings meaning. I personally think that's a very narrow, limited way to approach our existence on this planet if we need war and violence. But I'd like to think he means it's some sort of purpose. And indeed in the film, you know, the soundtrack, like you said, the drum beats and, you know, and throughout it, you've got references of hordes of people, masses coming together for a purpose. So, you know, is the purpose going to be violence, destruction, or is it going to be advancement? Mm.
And indeed, construction. If we're looking at the piece of Wells, the writer Stephen Baxter has said that from his perspective, writing in the present day, H.G. Wells would have been devastated. In fact, he was devastated when George Orwell actually pointed out that the rise of fascism and the rise of communism had kind of been prefigured by Wells' argument that actually society would be a lot better if it was being run by benevolent scientific dictators or despots. Mm-hmm. And I think there was that sort of sense that obviously Wells was clearly somebody who had an interesting personal life. He developed a writing style which was very much scientific romance, scientific adventure. We'd cited some of the key things that were actually there. When we come to Things to Come, although he'd written a novella back in the sort of latter part of the 1890s, The Shape of Things to Come, it is didactic. It actually deals with how Wells feels the world should be run. And he actually sort of presents it as a kind of future history. In a real sense, that kind of shows perhaps the power of influencing. I mean, we call this series The Culture Shapers for a reason, that it kind of opens up that sequence. It's interesting in terms of the film itself. Le Corbusier was an architect who was approached to actually take part in it. He didn't want to take part in the design, but he did actually approach many of the leading architects of the time to get a sense of a vision of the future and where we would actually be in the event of, obviously, the war, the world after the war.
Yes, and it's beautiful. I mean, the sets are striking. I would argue they still hold up right now. I think that they're stunning. And yeah, what you said about technology, I mean, there's a line in it that the Freemasonry of science are the trustees of civilization. Mm-hmm. And I obviously Wells's political views are apparent, his socialist leanings. And I don't know if it's important for us to get too bogged down in the politics, because what I see more important is this idea of scientists and culture shapers and artists, filmmakers, being lumped together on one side of advancing civilization and the other side are the politicians. I mean, if we want to make a blunt dichotomy between the two. And, you know, what I see, and because Wells is, you know, considered a visionary and, you know, a predictor of so many things that we're actually living now, and it's up to the scientists and the artists to maintain a vision of the future that involves progress and creation. And it's the politicians who are stagnant. They have one view. They have one view, which is we need to conquer. We need to conquer through destruction. We need to conquer through violence. And that's their idea of progress. So, you know, it's a blunt dichotomy, I think, that's happening. But if we want to apply it today to what I see happening, what we see happening in Silicon Valley, let's say, you know, where there's the tech industry, which, as you know, is, you know, 90% run by white males. So right there, we have an inherent problem in terms of the potential for something to go wrong when any one dominant group has control over certain technology. But one side note of these people in Silicon Valley that are creating and is that there's this optimism, there's this hope that technology can help us, that technology will save us from ourselves, will help us with a drought, will help us with our energy problem. That's my idea of the best that we can expect from a very powerful group of people, people who control a tremendous amount of money and corporate profit share. You know, do we believe them? Do we want to believe that they have our best, you know, intentions in mind? or are we going to say, well, they actually just want to take over too?
Looking at the timeline, I was fascinated to find that within the 1930s, obviously in 1932, Eric Kenton made The Island of Lost Souls, which was based on the island of Dr. Moreau, again another Wellesian, warning in many ways against genetic engineering and so on. Aldous Huxley published Brave New World. James Whale made The Invisible Man in 1933. And in 1936, when William Cameron Menzies' Things to Come, obviously produced, as we said, by Alexander Korda, was released in Britain, in America, it was the start of the Flash Gordon series, which is quite interesting in terms of the viewpoint there, the kind of Buster Crab Flash Gordon adventure serial, whereas at the same time you have this real attempt at what I would say is very serious, almost solemn, somber perspectives. You could argue, again, this comes across thanks to the actors involved. I mean, obviously, Raymond Massey and Ralph Richardson are legends in their own time and so on, and have become very much beloved actors in their own sort of way. But we did have a very British take on this. I mean, I start off by saying every town, I initially thought it was London. The lead character, I mean, obviously he becomes an airman, and Raymond Massey plays two parts in the whole sequence, obviously the airman and, of course, the latter part of the movie where we see him as the ruler, the leader of the organisation. There is a sense of Britishness, which is almost quite, I mean, you said this, I mean, the we're skipping ahead through all parts of the narrative here, but in terms of the child that I thought was, again, quite charming, the young girl who is actually being shown by her grandfather some of the history using video technology and the video phone and showing us how we kind of got to where we were. I mean, you could almost say that, in essence, the Gene Roddenberry viewpoint of Star Trek, that optimism, was also based on the fact that in order to get to an area which could be deemed to be a utopia, you kind of had to go through a whole range of challenges, including, obviously, this kind of war of attrition, this war that, and I'm sure that people who were living through the Second World War at the time, who had seen Things to Come, might have feared at the time that they were literally living that never-ending war, that notion that it was only a short while before the sleeping sickness would invade, before various other factors were coming on board. The use of gas masks, for instance, it was, I mean, thankfully, gas was never used by any of the enemies in the Second World War, but there was a thought that inevitably gas would be used, which was why every British household was equipped with gas masks. You know, so
sure, and it's iconic, and you know, you see there are scenes and things to come that you know Pink Floyd took directly and put it into the wall.
Yep.
You know, that the very iconic images. I remember as a child seeing images from the UK of the gas mask, very powerful.
And powerful because it also does away with humanity. I mean, the one thing about when you put up a gas mask on, in the traditional sense of the gas mask, you have the two large round circles, which are for the eyes, and then you have that kind of almost snorkel-like thing that projects out. It kind of becomes different. You are immediately in an alien mask culture, which sort of suggests that, you know, something is not quite right here. You're not being yourself.
No, absolutely. And, you know, just to go back a little bit about what you said about Roddenberry and the utopia of Star Trek, the dehumanization with the gas masks and this, it's made me think of beasts, you know, coming from hell, from the underworld. And in order to achieve a utopia, we must suffer, we must have dystopia. So there's, you know, that maps on very well with religious overtones, with, you know, the end times, you know, who shall be saved, who shall, you know, there's even though I know that there was no, at least I don't think, religious overtones with what Wells had in mind, I feel like it maps on very, very well biblically. Making it thus more universally identifiable, too.
It certainly is quite interesting because Fritz Lang's religious overtones are there and manifest, and they're writ large throughout the actual film with respect to Babel and the Tower of Babel and the collapse and all of those factors. Whereas, as you rightly say, within Things to Come, if anything, it's a totally atheistic movie. That, I mean, even the end, I mean, with no spoilers here, but I thought a very stirring speech where it's either this or nothing, and the heavenly choirs, which suggests that even to actually explore space, to take that next dimension, you still have to deal with the mob and the mass culture who basically have been stirred up and stirred to actually go into battle and actually destroy. And it's seen as almost the destroyer of worlds rather than the builder of worlds, that kind of constant binary opposition.
Right, absolutely. And I think thematically, the mobs, I'm fascinated with that. I've actually always had a personal... fear is not the right word, aversion to large crowds in stadiums, say, when the chanting starts, even if it's for something, you know, like a football match, just the chanting. I see mobs chanting and all gathering through, there is also that loss of humanity, as you mentioned, the gas masks. And I think that in this film, that is hammered in really strongly. Like, what is the mob going to do? Who tells people what to get outraged by in this future? What I see happening now, which alarms me, and I draw a direct parallel to the film, I feel the internet is telling the mobs what to be outraged by. I feel that there is a need out there. You know, the more and more isolated people get online, there's a need to gather the forces, gather the troops for an issue. And, you know, sometimes that issue can be great, like, let's stop cutting down the rainforests. There can be massive, wonderful mobilizations. But then there's a real dark side, and the dark side is the internet lynch mobs. When there's a video that gets released of you know, someone doing something seemingly outrageous, but it's taken completely out of context. I thought the first thing that comes to mind is this war correspondent photographer was photographing the Syrian refugees fleeing a border situation, a very bad, and she tripped one of them. Excuse me. And there's a video of her doing that. Within hours, she was getting death threats. That to me is really scary. And it's actually changed the way I interact online.
It's certainly one of those clear areas where we have the situation where Yeah, ultimately, I mean, we're having a conversation, we're having a discussion, we're using the technology, we're connecting from different countries, different continents, something which in even Wells' time would have been deemed absolutely... How can you... I mean, well, I suppose the telegraph was there, you could have connected, you wouldn't necessarily have had that sort of sharing of experience. But it's really, again, that two sides of the argument. Wells himself was 67 when Things to Come effectively emerged. It's argued that, rather like most folk who become more chronologically gifted, that you get a display of certainty, that actually age to a certain extent often is told by people who are more mature, that actually things like the society collapse is occurring, that society is ending, and people actually need firm guidance to help them pull through. I remember my own parents actually saying that as you become more mature, you tend to become more conservative or right-wing. I mean, is that something which we can look at and sort of say that from Wells' point of view and from Alexander Korda and obviously from Menzies' point of view, you're kind of thinking, well, yeah, this is a warning. You know, it is meant to be a warning, but it's also meant to be an indication that as well as being aware of the challenges, there is a very bright future ahead if you will actually collaborate and work together.
You know, that's so interesting because I see what you mean by there seems to be that idea that the older you get, you know, the more conservative. I actually see just the opposite. And I take the ending of this film, this, well, what is it going to be? Are we going to keep going or is this just it? That it's, we're here on this planet to keep evolving, to keep growing, to keep exploring. And this is why Star Trek was so critical for me in terms of shaping my worldview, shaping the culture that I would feed myself with to help me realize like what I wanted to put out there in the world. It's as I get older, as I have more experience with the world, you know, I actually feel less conservative. I feel that it's a choice we make. It's a choice we make. Do we follow the crowd with fear that's, you know, it's based in fear, it's based in conflict and thus contracting, conservative, or do we think individually, but yet act on behalf of the whole, act on behalf of the crowd, on the mob, as individuals? That's the choice. And it was so starkly laid out for me by Wells and then, you know, Roddenberry taking up the mantle with his vision of a future. And, you know, it's all we can do as people who are creating to make the decision. Well, what are we going to put into the world, into culture? How can our voices influence and shape and determine the path that we're going, and you know, it's sometimes it's an uphill battle. And you know, I was watching some of our Republican debate here, you know, for our political season, which is in full swing, and you know, it's all I'm struck by is that this is a party of fear. This is a party of stagnation. Let's complain. Let's induce the riot mob. Let's get those pitchforks out and talk about what we hate without offering any actual constructive proposals for how we can make things better. And that's the hero of Shape Things to Come. You know, it's about what we can do. Look what we can do. We can really work for the better together.
The movie is full of wonderful vignettes and moments, and one which also is very striking is shortly into the war, where the airman effectively gets shot down and there's a battle in the skies, and then there's the moment where the Roman Massad character effectively meets up with his enemy and realises almost that there's a shared bonding, and he provides the gas mask to actually prevent him dying, but the enemy ultimately gives up his gas mask and gives it to save the child.
Yeah.
And again, we talked about obviously the collective, But on an individual basis, again, there's a message there in terms of fundamentally the war, which we never really find out what it was about, what the purpose of the war was. We just know that war was the case and that was what was happening and that political decisions had been made to take us to war, to take the world to war and so on. And yet we still had those moments where there was still just a slight flickering, rather like a candle in the proverbial wind that sort of would still say, well, actually, there is a side of the human spirit that you can nurture, but it's very delicate. Unless you actually look after that spirit, then effectively you are actually sleepwalking. You become one of the sleeping sickness people. You effectively sort of end everything. I've often thought that the use of the sleeping sickness, it's almost a precursor to shows like The Walking Dead and the zombie movies and so on.
Yes, the zombie movies, absolutely. You know, and that's why it's funny because I really don't like horror genre, but I really do enjoy zombie movies, and I think it's because they're just it's a very rich metaphor for some of our cultural ills. Absolutely, you know, I it's funny because there's this tension between the group and the individual, where we place ourselves, our need for community, our need for solitude, how we can nurture our spirits when we're alone, how we can nurture our community, our friends, family. And it was a little simpler before the internet. And, you know, obviously I'm not a Luddite. I love technology, but it was simpler in the sense that it was just all laid out. Like, you had your community, your family. There might be a phone call coming in every now and then, but, you know, you would just pick it up and be like, who could this be? I'll just engage with someone outside myself. And there's this technology now, especially social media and the internet, that I feel there's a real danger, because especially with, say, Facebook, you know, Twitter, is that it allows us to isolate ourselves. But by mixing our appetite for isolation and solitude, mixes it with our need and our vanity to present ourselves to, you know, untold thousands of people, perhaps the world, it actually threatens what solitude is and what being alone is and what nourishing ourselves as individuals can be, because it's really hard to be alone now if you're a part of the wired world, which I know many, many people are not, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So I see it as an incredibly powerful tool, and we need time alone in order to have those moments of individual spirit, like the man giving his gas mask. We need to be able to think for ourselves and to not always follow the crowd. So, you know, I think we're at an interesting point, and I actually don't know which way it's going to go. I hope it doesn't keep getting, I hope it doesn't keep going in the direction it's going, because I feel like I'm losing.
Have you got the airplanes going over there in the background, Ilana? It sounds as though you've actually got airplanes from the actual movie traveling over overhead. It's wonderful. It's great to see that Hollywood has this magic of being able to actually sort of work through that without sound effects as well. Genius stuff.
Oh, wow. You can hear that. That's flying right over the Hollywood sign.
Well, there you go. Again, from the point of view of you're listening to a program called The Culture Shapers. I know we're looking to rerun these over the holiday season as well, as obviously being online, so you can download them as and when, courtesy of Siren FM and Southside Broadcasting. But let's move back to something else which is quite interesting insofar as every town. Clearly, we keep coming back to that because although the time changes, the space is what we are watching. Yeah. It's the same space. It's the same kind of iconography that we actually have from that early recognisable 1930s British city or city in the Western Hemisphere that effectively then sort of changes over time from that underground utopia or right the way to an underground utopia via a bombed out ruin. And again, you know, we see the changes. So it's space, remains the same, but time, that travel through time that sort of works through. And again, I thought the way in which the march of time was developed was that sort of notion of progression after a fashion. Let's consider the medieval time that we go through, where we actually have what would probably be seen as the medieval warrior kings that would actually there, and the chap who clearly loses the plot, believes that actually the strength is there, still maintains that if he can only get some more airplanes in the sky and get the oil and the fuel sorted out, he can still win the war, and it's a war, and it's almost pathetic when you actually watch him. There's a pathos that we see in the character in terms of, you know, he's assisted by his concubine and the suggestion that she's quite taken, and then suddenly the airman arrives. And yes, the game changes.
Right. They're almost like aliens coming. Mm. And absolutely, the game changes. And, you know, that happens now, too. There are parts of the world, this goes back to it, it seems who's wired and who's not. There are parts of the world where you could just get off an airplane and you'd be back in, you know, the 1930s. There are parts of the world that have been bombed out, that continue to exist in that early phase of things to come. You know, we can time travel right here, right now, today in our world. So that's one thing you don't quite get in the movie. The every town. I didn't quite buy that it would be every town on the planet. But I see what the point was, because in Basra, I think that's the location that they picked, yep, for where they did advance technologically, mm-hmm, and where we did fly from in the airmen. I find it actually really interesting that it's someplace in the Middle East, mm-hmm, that was chosen, especially considering what's going on now in the Middle East and how we've just re-embraced the notion of the doctrine of endless war with ISIS. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically our policy now. Like, well, gotta face it, guys. We're going to be engaged with these monstrous people, mm-hmm, for who knows how long. A long time. Let's just hope your kids don't get drafted.
And of course, the other side of things you could argue is that Dubai is a case of the other side of the dream, the kind of the absolute sort of technological elite and giant-sized buildings and huge buildings and structures, which maybe suggest that actually there is an interesting connection there to be developed and so on. One of the unkind criticisms that I'd heard about the movie was it was somewhat ponderous. Now, I could appreciate this at one level, that it does seem to be a bit didactic, a bit British, let's be honest, in terms of you think, good Lord, we could actually deal with a bit more action and pace here. But at the same time, do you feel that in that kind of the demands it makes of the audience to stick with it, to actually see the way the thing does actually evolve and develop, is that part of the pleasure that we actually get in experiencing it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you have to, it's indulgent, absolutely. There are many scenes that would not test well with a contemporary audience, mm, for how long they go on. You know, more films are edited faster, you know, flashier, more explosions, to satisfy some sort of, you know, adrenaline rush that's expected now with entertainment. So yeah, when you sit back and you say, okay, I'm going to watch a film from the 1930s, you have to really get into that headspace. And I thought it was delicious and luxurious. I loved looking at the sets. I mean, you know, Menzies, he was an art director on, you know, 20, 30 films. So, you know, not a surprise that these sets are absolutely gorgeous. There was a bit, you know, everyone says socialism, but I actually was like, I wrote the word down, fascist. You know, let's look at the man merging with the machine and, you know, the glory of the mechanics of, I thought of Reifenstahl a bit. You know, I thought, you know, look at the achievements, look at what we can do, and you know, the glorification of the mechanical and the technological progress, to me was, you know, it was beautiful to watch, but it was also a little
Because obviously Leni van Riefenstahl was indeed at the height of her filmmaking prowess as a propagandist for the Nazi Party in Germany at the time. And although we don't get the sort of sense of the Übermensch that's actually there, or the Superman that's much beloved, of course, of Nietzsche and so on, you still get this sort of notion, as you say, of there is a progress and there is a very clean technological, there's a cutting edge, as indeed the population goes underground, which again I thought was quite interesting, because it's a total, is it a reverse of Wells's suggestion in The Time Machine, that there we have the Eli who are left on the surface and the Morlocks who effectively have the technology underground, but effectively because they spend their time underground, they ultimately devolve. Would we actually see, if we projected ahead a few more centuries, a few more millennia, with the things to come version of reality, would effectively the so-called technocrats and the technocratic gods of the underworld effectively be devolving into their own primeval aspects as well?
Sure, I could see that, absolutely. And again, you know, we have, you know, some classic Judeo-Christian, you know, below, above, as above, so below. I mean, you know, you've got, it's hard not to wonder why they felt like they had to go underground, because it's not like there was radiation poisoning or anything like that. That's actually a plot point. I don't quite get why they did that.
Could it be fear? I mean, again, ultimately, you look at the Anderson set shelters. I mean, clearly, that's a different cultural side of things, because in Britain, because of bombing raids, and that obviously did manifest itself. There were bombing raids in the First World War, but one of the aspects about that was to develop underground shelters, and the notion that clearly in the Blitz, both in London and indeed in other cities, if there was a case of going underground, in the case of the London Underground, quite literally, that's where people would hide.
Sure. You know, and that's the thing. I mean, there's this constant tension between how the society chooses to live. You know, who decides action? Who decides when a state can act? You know, is it a small cabal of people? You know, and these dystopian fantasies are told. And Wells, you know, he forecasted as a possibility this population that would allow itself to be swayed by the politics of fear. So perhaps, you know, okay, so we've got to go underground. Is that a move out of fear for something else happening? Or is it a move, practical move? You know, who's to say, like, what's motivated out of fear? Because it's very subtle in this film. Wells is, you know, it's not like the Republican Party saying, you know, we got to build a wall against the immigrants, they're ruining our lives, you know, stuff like that. This is more like, you know, look what happens. Clearly, our lives are better. We're not being bombed anymore. We can aspire to go to the stars now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're doing that. Why are we doing that? You know, so I there's a tension there. And, you know, it ended on a high note, I guess, as much as you could say, but still left a little uneasy with the whole thing.
It was both a metaphorical and a literal high, in terms of we see the rocket ship going out there, and that moment where there's, look, there they are, there they go, and onwards from that perspective. Briefly returning to Wells and his authoritarianism, again, that we see with respect to that, there's lots of improvement of a planned society with eugenics, social engineering, things we don't really see manifest in the movie, although I think they could possibly be implied in certain other areas. In other words, it's progress which is imposed from above, and it's really seen as the sort of systems by the sort of dictatorship of the airmen. I mean, the airmen, who are kind of this band of scientists who we kind of would tend to think as, well, they're the heroes, they are the good guys, obviously they're looking through that. But it's interesting in terms of the movie, and I know it's monochrome, but surely the actual initial suit that we see the first airman, Raymond Massey, actually wearing, it looks quite a threatening alien suit, with a very large helmet, the sort of the darkness that's actually there. They don't necessarily look like the traditional cavalry that are riding over the hill.
No, you're right. And that's, you know, the alien metaphor, I think, is really great, because, you know, there's certain cultures that are around that if we did just come down in one of our jets, they perhaps might think, you know, who are these people? These are alien. But the outfits are funny because, you know, The Simpsons, which is one of the most, and the Futurama, I'm sorry, which is one of my absolute favorite shows of all time. The comical spaceman, Zach Brannigan, you know, the blonde, they modeled those suits after this film, clearly. I mean, the short shorts, but they exaggerated it. Completely.
And as I say, we're using music as an underpinning lead, etc. But the actual aircraft you can actually hear are genuine. It's quite interesting. It's wonderful the way we've sorted this thing through. Question that I think probably we need to consider in terms of there was a version in 1979 by George McCowan, which effectively most people would say bore little resemblance to the original book other than the name, The Shape of Things to Come. If somebody offered you the chance to direct a remake of The Things to Come, would you say, yes, I'll go with that? Or would you say, I don't know, we should leave it as it is as a 1936 icon?
No, absolutely. No, I would do it in a hot minute because I actually... I'm trying to come up with a film that to do in one house right now, just as an exercise, because the film I'm currently working on with Brian is sprawling and massive and dynastic. And the next film I want it to be quite small. And I was like, you know, I actually could come up with an adaptation in that could take place in one house of this movie. And it would be very interesting. I think I don't, obviously I'm not saying, oh, it's going to be as good as Wells. That's not, I don't have the ego for that, but I think it's this type of story that, is asking for people to continually adapt it. It's almost Shakespearean, in that sense. It needs to be adapted. It needs to be updated because the original is so strong. It doesn't need to be improved on. I just think it can evolve and be a template for contemporary artists and filmmakers to explore.
Well, the 80th anniversary, of course, is in 2016, so maybe that might be an opportunity to look for the whole sort of sequence. But we'll progress onwards momentarily, because time is again of the essence, and we're, even though we've had a wonderful discourse about the sort of themes, I've shared some of my kind of particular highlights of the movie and where it actually works for me in terms of the narrative and how even with the cut glass received pronunciation English accents that are actually there, there's still a kind of reality, a verisimilitude that actually is around. Are there any moments from your own perspective that with respect, I mean, you mentioned the machine and the building, the rebuilding of every town and so on. Any other areas which you sort of think, That actually was a worthwhile decision to actually film that particular sequence in that way?
Yeah, the acting, the way the people are, the way, excuse me, Massey and Chapman, and the way they interact, their dialogue I felt was natural. And their expressions were real. I was like, wow, this is something they're really thinking about. There was nothing hammy about it. It felt real to me, and that's what kept me engaged, even despite the accents and despite some of the, there was some, you know, chunkiness about it, but it's the acting kept me anchored.
And of course, even allowing for that, we still had a sequence whereby, a bit like other movies of the time, and certainly Metropolis suffered from us for many, many years, there are around about 15, 20 minutes of Things to Come which have been lost and presumably will never actually return. So we still have not been able to see it in its kind of full uncut version. And when it was obviously screened in the States and other countries, inevitably the editors get to work on the whole thing. They change bits out, they move things around. So maybe that kind of sense of delivery. I know in terms of female characters, there was certainly more that was originally, if we compare the screenplay, we are in a fortunate position to actually look at the published screenplay that Wells produced for Things to Come and what was actually filmed, that there was a bigger role for women, because that's another accusation you could make, saying it's a very male-dominated film and the only women you actually see there, apart from the young girls, are either assistants in terms of assistants of the doctor, or indeed they're concubines in a sort of medieval sort of throwback to the time, etc. But I think the narrative of those characters could possibly have done with maybe a little bit more embellishment.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it's sad to think, oh, well, what, we don't really expect it. But it, in a way, it was made up for me when they both, the man and the woman, the children, both of them, just get on into that spaceship. Yeah. And it's just assumed. And to me, that was perhaps one of the most resounding points when he said, you know, if we... we cannot send anyone else's children up there if we don't send ours. And I saw that as it was beautiful and moving and, you know, predictive of wars that were upcoming, such as the Vietnam War, you know, where the elite decided to make this war, but the majority of the people that went to fight it were other people's children, poor children. Whereas, you know, World War One, World War Two, these were wars considered wars of honor, where all classes went to fight these wars. I'm speaking, you know, America. Mm-hmm. And I found that, you know, resoundingly predictive and moving when they said that, okay, we're going to send our kids up there. This is what we have to do.
And of course, prefiguring the notion that it was Valentina Tereshkova from the Soviet Union who was the first woman in space, which I don't think Wells would have necessarily been that happy with, but that's another line. It took a wee while for America to actually sort of get the genders balanced. We're in the future. We are in the 21st century. Some people refer to this as things to come. Some people refer to it as the shape of things to come. Some people, H.G. Wells, the shape of things to come, or even the original A Story of the Days to Come. It's been wonderful sharing some thoughts with your good self, Ilana. Any closing thoughts you'd like to make for people listening into this podcast and really sort of a reason as to, in terms of why they should go and see the movie?
Well, I think that any material by H.G. Wells for film fans, for science fiction film fans, especially for fantasy film fans, it's critical. It's important to put work in context. I think we're in danger culturally, especially with science fiction, of things turning into sensory explosions. This adrenaline rush, this need to be entertained. And this film brings us back to a point where, you know, issues were considered. And I feel like the greatest science fiction that I love now, and some of the films that you've chosen for your podcast and a series like Battlestar Galactica, these are films that were made people who were thoroughly grounded in films such as Things to Come and works by visionaries like Wells. So, you know, just it's kind of critical material.
Ilana, it's been a pleasure as expected and a genuine delight. And I know we'll speak together on various other Midweek Drive shows and various other bits and pieces, but thank you for sharing with us your thoughts on H.G. Wells' Things to Come for this, the Culture Shapers podcast. Thank you, Ilana.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a real pleasure.